In a moment, paranormal researcher and expert on the occult, Konstantinos, joins us. We will explore, of course, vampires, the different types, the immortal blood drinkers, and psychic vampires, the dead and demons, and much more on Coast to Coast AM. Konstantinos is an occult writer. He's an expert consultant on occult topics, author of Vampires, the Occult Truth, Nocturnal Witchcraft, many more, the popular Speak with the Dead, Seven Methods for Spirit Communication. A noted expert in white noise and psychic phenomenon, he has been featured in the New York Post, on the Ricky Lake Show, CNBC's After Hours, MTV's The Big Urban Myth Show, Sci-Fi Channel's Declassifying Evil, and the Discovery Channel's documentary Twisted History. Konstantinos is currently working on Demons, the Occult Truth, which will explore realities of entities and the ways they have interacted with humankind throughout history. And is this right, Konstantinos? Were you on about 11 years ago on the program?
Yeah, I was on with Art Bell, August 96.
God, long time ago. I saw your picture today. I thought, my gosh, you look like Chris Angel, an uncanny resemblance. Did you know that?
Well, we're both Greek, and we're both from Long Island, so that'll do it.
Well, welcome to the program. I'm looking forward to this today, especially with some of the things we're going to be doing this week. I might take some of your advice. How did you get involved with all of this, the occult?
That would actually be my Greek grandmother.
Really?
Yeah. When I was young, she would babysit me and my sister, and she would tell us stories about the old country. And while my sister would fall asleep, I would sort of be fascinated and stay up all night listening. She would tell us about the dead knocking on your door, asking for food, and curses and other types of spells that people did there.
What, did it become an obsession as you got older to study this?
Well, when I was young and I would listen to the stories, it always sounded like there was a common thread, like there was something that made all those different kinds of stories seem related to each other. So I gradually became interested in finding out what that common thread was, and that's when I discovered the word, the occult, which just basically means the hidden.
Were you able to study from anybody, or did you have to basically, once you got through the grandmother moment, go out and study yourself?
Yeah, it was a lot of self-study, a lot of tracking down old books, and also coming across people at the most unlikely moments, bits of synchronicity, if you will. They just seem to come into your life when you need them. It's kind of interesting how that works out.
You know, and I've noticed in your work, Konstantinos, you've touched on a lot of really the pluses and minuses of the occult and what's out there, like vampires, like speaking with the dead, summoning up spirits. All of them, I would guess, are pretty dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
Anything could be dangerous, I guess, if you don't know what you're doing. It's a raw, untapped energy form for most people, and when they first step into that sphere of being, sometimes the experiences could get out of hand. That's why I try to prepare people. But it's like that with anything, whether it's paranormal or normal. You have to prepare and go in aware of all the ramifications of your actions.
Are there a lot of occultists like yourself out there that really understand what they're doing?
I mean, there are a lot of people who dabble, and that could get dangerous kind of fast, right? I mean, if you go into it not really prepared for the commitment and the study required, that gets kind of dangerous. I see a lot of dabblers, people who just want a quick fix, something that will work fast to solve their problems. And sometimes they're not ready for the forces that come back.
Are there some people out there that dabble with this because they themselves might be evil? Maybe they want to put hexes and spells on people? I mean, they're out to hurt people?
Well, yeah. I mean, you can use anything for good or evil, really. And one of the most base emotions, I guess, is anger. If people are ticked off, they will look for the easiest way. Sometimes in some states, that's walking into a store where you can get a gun without waiting a few days. And in the case of the occult, people think that they could cast spells and destroy their enemies. But it's interesting how the universe sort of takes care of itself there. If you go into it with such negativity in mind, usually those forces end up coming back to haunt you.
Tenfold sometimes, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have you give us some examples a little bit later on. In this country specifically, are there a number of people or groups that are beginning to join together You know, we've got the one end, people who are ultra religious. Are there people who dabble in the occult and it's almost a religion for them?
Sure. Some people approach it purely on religious grounds, like Wiccans, for example. For them, the occult and magic are intertwined with religion 100%. But there are groups now. I mean, the internet makes it easier to reach out and find like-minded individuals. It's things that used to be extremely obscure can now amass relatively large numbers of people in a short period of time using something like a website or a forum. You can call together even 10 or 15 people and end up with something kind of impressive.
Lots of things we'll be doing on Wednesday, and I'm going to get your advice later in this program because I'm beginning to change my mind somewhat. You have done a lot of work in summoning up spirits. We'll talk about that. But let's spend a little time here, if we can, Konstantinos, about the vampires. You basically have broken down vampirism three different ways: immortal blood drinkers, and psychic vampires. Let's go through all three of them, first of all.
Sure.
The immortal blood drinkers, what are they? Who are they?
Well, the immortal blood drinkers, those are the ones that you end up seeing in most movies. They're the vampires of folklore, the risen dead who feast on the blood of the living at night to sustain their undead existence. They're the ones that the evidence sort of dies down a few hundred years ago, and they're the ones that most likely were believed in because of a misunderstanding of the death process, and we could talk more about that in a bit. The mortal blood drinkers are the sort of, I guess, people who feel the need to drink blood today. They normally dress like vampires and participate in like a lifestyle. It becomes a social, sometimes sexual act, and they're for the most part, harmless. I mean, they have consensual adults who donate their blood for those kinds of relationships. And the psychic vampires are the ones that probably have the most basis in occult fact. They're the ones who feel the need, either intentionally or unintentionally, to drain life force or energy from other living people. And they feel that it makes them more powerful than others sometimes. Sometimes they just really have the need because of a energy lacking that they feel.
Would that include some people who probably don't even know they're doing this?
Yeah, those are the ones I call the unintentional psychic vampires. People who are ill sometimes, especially if, let's say, an older person is ill and they're in a house with someone who's much younger and vibrant, just through natural osmosis, energy flows that way in the universe.
Now, the immortal blood drinkers, are they real or is it all Hollywood? Is it all the old...
Yeah, it seems to be mostly Hollywood. From what I found, all the evidence just, it dies down, like I said. It seems that when people would dig up corpses a long time ago because an outbreak of a disease would hit a village, they would find this bloated body with what seemed to be fresh blood coming out of its mouth and freshly growing nails and growing hair. And what was really happening was the skin would be curling back to reveal things like longer teeth and longer nails. And when they drove a stake in these things, they would groan, they would emit blood. But it was really a physiological process.
Okay. Vlad the Impaler, though real, wasn't a vampire.
No, although there's the fun folklore, fun, I guess, if you like vampires, that he would sometimes dip bread into blood of his victims or just drink it straight from a cup. I mean, he was ruling at a time where keeping order required extreme measures, and his favorite method of punishment was impalement. And it is true that a lot of people saw him as a hero because he kept things in order. I mean, he would leave coins at a well and hide in the bushes with his men to see if anyone would take them, and no one would because they were too afraid of being impaled.
The old finders keepers didn't hold up with him, did it?
Yeah, no.
I guess you could consider him then a mortal blood drinker, right?
You could. I mean, if the stories are true, it's hard to say. Some things get better with retelling, and just because of those types of associations that he had in that area, was he involved in supernatural forces? Was he larger than life? That kind of stuff intrigued Bram Stoker, and that's why he chose him as his fictional vampire. So it's not, certain whether or not he actually did do the drinking.
But. So you're pretty sure then that we don't have some thousand-year-old vampires roaming this planet right now?
I think by now they would have sought me out, right?
Yeah, they would have. In one way or another, they would have come after you.
Yeah, that's true.
The mortal blood drinkers, are these the people, Constantinos, who go to the dentist and get, you know, those vampire teeth capped on their teeth?
Oh, sure. Some of them do. They don't really work too well for, quote-unquote, feeding some of those things. They actually cause a lot of pain and discomfort. So even the ones with the best fangs usually end up drawing the blood out with something like a normal syringe and drinking it out of a glass. Or making little slits with a razor or a sharp lancet or something like that. But they do it as living part of the magnetic lifestyle. They'll put in contacts to make their eyes look like giant black spheres, and they're all enwrapped in the mystique too. And I mean, I guess that's okay. People do all sorts of things to express themselves. But what's interesting is most of the immortal blood drinkers, they do start to dress that way and act that way after they've discovered Anne Rice or some other vampire first. I've yet to really come across one I can prove from a very young age started wearing a cape at, let's say, 3 or 4 and, you know, tried to fly out the window or something.
Well, and, you know, we hear all kinds of stories crossing this desk, and I have not heard one of a person committing vampirism on someone, attacking someone, trying to suck their blood out of them. I'm sure it happens, but I haven't heard many cases.
Yeah, every once in a while you hear one. There was a few years ago, there was a woman found wandering the street, and she had been kidnapped, and it turns out a guy was holding her and draining her blood, but that he never really even did that before. He was just all sorts of sexual perversions.
Yeah, he was just a wacko. Yeah.
And there are, of course, like vampire-inspired murders that happen every once in a great while. But usually you'll find that they're disturbed people committing those acts, right? I mean, there are people who go into a school with a gun.
I suppose.
That's a different kind of disturbed act, too. So, yeah, it's best to look for those kinds of warnings, warning signs before things like that happen.
As a researcher, have you ever witnessed any of these events, any of these gatherings?
Gatherings, yes. Violence, I've been lucky enough to not see. Mostly, I mean, I've been invited to events. There's, like, for example, the Court of Lazarus in New York, where they do very controlled form of blood drinking. They have their own secret little rituals that occur behind the scenes. And it's, I guess, if it's all consenting adults and they know what they're getting into, that's fine. But let's face it, I mean, drinking blood is probably the least safe.
I wouldn't say it's very, very healthy to do that.
Yeah.
Are there some people, some individuals, names that would boggle our minds if we knew who they were? Anybody of notoriety?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that any super...
So the elitists of this world are not playing vampires.
Yeah, no, there isn't some like secret cabal of former presidents or something. I mean, not that I know of. That'd make a great Dan Brown album, I'm sure.
Exactly. We could call a movie Eyes Wide Shut or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, and then the psychic vampires, of course, and as you mentioned, they are people who literally draw energy from people, other people who don't know they're doing this. But how does it happen? Why does it happen?
Well, in part, like I mentioned, osmosis before, if someone does have less energy, the universe loves equilibrium. I mean, you see it in all sorts of systems. It just wants everything to be in one level playing ground. So if you have something putting off a lot of energy and something without a lot of energy, it's just going to flow that way, the path of least resistance. Now, if it happens often enough and the person feels better often enough, they just sort of subconsciously learn how to do it. It's like biofeedback. Like you can teach yourself how to make your hand get warmer or colder or something.
And they begin to enjoy it, don't they?
Yeah, without even knowing why. They just will feel better around a certain person and they'll always want to be around them. And likewise, certain people always end up feeling uncomfortable around a certain person.
Well, that's true. I mean, we've all been to a party or an event or somewhere where you know who the psychic vampire in the room is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not always just boredom. Sometimes there might be an occult cause.
Were they born this way, you think? As children, it was the same? Or did it develop later on in their lives?
The unintentional ones, I think, definitely develop. I think something occurs, some underlying illness. I've seen it several times. I still hear about it in letters from readers. Something just comes over that person, some kind of illness, and they really just can't help it. It's something that makes them feel better. And on a mild level, it's actually not that bad. Like if the person were around a lot of really energetic individuals and they started to feel a little better, who knows? I mean, it could actually have a good result. What's dangerous is when someone decides to practice that as their form of personal empowerment, because then it does become a malicious act, and it could really lead to energetic people becoming not so energetic and actually rather ill.
Have you ever been summoned by police and they say, hey, we need your help here, Constantinos, this is a bizarre case here?
No, I haven't done any sort of high-profile police case or anything like that. Anything I might have done was strictly off the record.
You won't tell us, will you?
Yeah, strictly off the record.
You know, a dentist who gives someone one of these fang caps, I mean, why do they do this? Don't they, with their own profession, want to say, I'm not going to do this to you? I mean, I guess they have them sign releases and things, huh?
Well, I mean, it's cosmetic. It's someone's choice, I suppose, right? I mean, you can get caps. You can get caps to make yourself look like a horse, I suppose, if you want.
If you want to.
Yeah. And, of course, if a dentist gets good at that and builds up notoriety for it, it's a way to differentiate and get a different class of clientele, I suppose.
Are there some dentists who basically are specialists at vampire caps?
A true dentist that's a specialist. I know there are ones that are considered specialists, but they still also do fillings and things like that.
But they're good at this.
Yeah, exactly. There are like fang makers who go to events and things, but they usually build something that you put in like temporarily. It's like a little like wire behind the teeth sort of bridge set up.
Do some of these mortal blood drinkers play the game of they don't go out in the sun either or anything like that?
Oh, sure. And
really?
Someone will tell you that was one of the first symptoms to manifest from a young age. But usually when they're studied or their blood is analyzed, they'll find that there's really no underlying physiological cause. I do believe in most cases it's psychological. But, you know, it's interesting. If people believe something enough and stick to it enough, they create their own sort of mini reality, their own thought form. And a lot of what I found in the occult is you can very much create your own reality. So even though these kids aren't going to live forever or probably fly anytime soon, they may start to experience certain phenomenon that will make them believe that maybe something deeper is going on. And it is all self-induced, and it doesn't have to be self-induced in the guise of vampirism, but it happens.
And do they act this way all the time, 24/7, or are there moments where they become relatively normal people? You can't even tell the difference who they are.
Well, I mean, with some of them, it's a matter of survival. If they have like a normal kind of desk job or something.
So some of them do.
Yeah, they have to.
We could be working next to these vampires and not even know what you're saying.
Exactly. You know, they'll look all normal during the day, and then at night they'll go out and act their fantasies, which I guess just about everyone does in some form or other.
They find the right places, the right clubs, I guess, to do this?
Yeah, exactly. Safety numbers. They find places where people of like minds get together and they share their ideas and their actions.
All right, stay with us, Constantinos. When we come back, we'll talk about speaking with the dead. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Constantinos' website, Constantinos.com. That's with a K. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Next hour, I'm going to devote the entire hour to speaking with him about summoning up spirits and the Ouija board. And when we come back, we'll talk about speaking with the dead on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with our special guest tonight, Constantinos, speaking with the dead. So you've done a lot of work in this area. A lot of work. Is it because of technology that has made this so easy now?
It really has. I mean, it's been getting easier, and you'll see it appear more and more in even TV shows now because it is so easy to get results, especially if you have an environment to practice in that is conducive, let's say a so-called haunted house or a place that's full of activity.
If we ever get our sci-fi show back and off the ground, I want to have you on it with us because I think you'd offer some incredible insight. Your new book, Speak with the Dead, you point out seven methods for spirit communication. Let's go through some of those if we can. Seven methods.
Okay, a few of them are sort of elaborations on the same idea, the recording of voices. And electronic voice phenomenon, I mean, everyone's seen it by now. It's the idea that the dead can influence magnetic media or other kinds of media to imprint voices. So in the book, I go through the methods for just capturing voices from the air without anything but a recorder. Then we move into using white noise, which there was a movie I was seeing.
Oh, yeah. Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Did you like that movie? Hollywood, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it sort of went way off there. And, I mean, I guess there would have even been better ways to do that. But it was funny. I mean, you can almost watch Michael Keaton on the interviews for that, not seem that into it after, like, day one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, the idea is still there that using some kind of material, like white noise or static, it makes it easier to manipulate and create voices. But lately, more and more people have just been experimenting with pure recording with high-quality gear, like either a hard drive or a digital recorder. There's no interference, no hissing that's not conducive to detecting voices. And once you capture something now, it's becoming easier. As you mentioned technology, it's easier now to grab the waveform on a computer and amplify just a specific area using something like Cool Edit Pro or other widely available software.
Right.
And then you could just bring it out and hear it and slow it down and speed it up. And sometimes changing the speed makes it easier to recognize if it's a guy or girl or maybe even someone you know.
If you get a moment while you're chatting with us tonight, to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the feature email that was sent in by one of our listeners. Give me your impression, if you can, on that photograph of what looks like an angel floating on the water. And, you know, a lot of things we can do with, you know, Photoshop and things, but this one's pretty eerie. And, you know, I'm not so sure that that's a doctored picture. That might be the real deal. But I want to get you
it right now.
Okay. Do you see it right there on the homepage?
Yeah. Let's see.
Isn't that weird?
It's definitely hard to tell. I mean, that's.
It's a good one, whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, the source. The size of the source material is not quite big enough to be able to...
Well, you can click that. It'll open
it
up
for
you.
No, I did. Yeah,
okay.
I brought it up. I'm looking at it in high resolution. It's possible. I've definitely seen stranger.
Yeah. Why are they captured? You know, those that are real, those that are out there, these images, why are they captured on film or digital? I mean,
It's basically just another form of emulsion, another form of getting an energy form onto something that captures it. I mean, using photographic plates to capture energy is a very old practice. I mean, it's still used in some form when you're doing quantum mechanics experiments. If you want to try and understand particle behavior, you'll still use essentially a glorified photo plate to capture something that's normally invisible. So if you want to talk about the type of energy that's easily manipulated, very subtle energy can be easily recorded onto film more easily than it could be detected with the human eye.
Yeah, I was going to say, because very rarely do people ever see anything, but as soon as they go back and look at their film or look at the digital, there it is.
Yeah, it's the idea that a lot of phenomena are based on the idea that the energy's there and these sort of signals are there, but we're not really able to tune into them all the time. We're in so-called daytime consciousness too often. We're focusing on work or whatever, and we sort of shut down those parts of our mind that could be tuning in. That's sort of how the Ouija board works, really. I mean, you can think of the Ouija board as like, let's say it's drizzling all over your town. That water won't really do much, but if you had a giant funnel and you tuned it all in like a laser beam, it would blast a hole through the ground. That's sort of how a Ouija board works.
Yeah, we'll get your take on that next hour, and I'm looking forward to that. Now, the EVPs, those sounds, some people have said, Konstantinos, that really what these are sounds coming from another dimension. you know, I tend to think it's a ghostly sound on some kind of entity that is still here that hasn't moved on. What's your take?
It could be from another dimension, but it's defined dimension, right? Like some people's theories of the afterlife are that it's just another dimension.
True.
There's the idea of just multiple possibilities, parallel universes. I mean, in science, there's the principle where if you don't necessarily observe something, it exists in multiple states of probability. So if there's multiple parallel universes like that, sure, we could be picking up those voices. We could even be picking up people who recently died here but maybe didn't die in one of those parallel universes. It's certainly possible.
Are the voices always out there? We just haven't heard them or we haven't recorded them? Or do they pop up when they are asked to?
I've definitely found that the experimenter affects the experiment when it comes to EVP, just like a lot of other bizarre phenomena. If you have this sincere intent to try and capture these voices, they do seem to manifest. Now, is that truly a supernatural thing? Not necessarily. That happens in even simple particle physics experiments. The experimenter wanting a particle to go one way or another can make it go that way. So there's definitely something going on there with our intent sort of reaching out and meeting these other minds and getting them to respond.
Must the person have died in that location for that entity to appear as an EVP, or are they just scattered all over the place?
Yeah, I've seen results at graveyards. I've seen results just with an item that belonged to the person. I've seen results with just a photo, which leads me to believe it might have a lot to do with the mind of the experimenter. You sort of tune in and use that as like a focusing point, something to reach out with.
I was going to say that with so many billions of people who have died over the eons, why aren't we having sound clutter, with voices everywhere, stepping on each other? You could barely understand them because they're all talking.
Well, I think they would be broadcasting using part of the electromagnetic spectrum that, normal radio doesn't pick up, normal TV doesn't pick up. And I think our minds are more finely tuned, and they can, through something like a photograph or a place or a piece of clothing or something, reach out and try and connect and make that link. I definitely don't think they follow the normal laws of, the FCC's regulation on broadband.
Yeah, exactly. Another way, of course, to try to contact the dead is telepathy.
Yes, definitely. And some people who start with electronic voice phenomena, and there's a reason I put those methods in that order in the book, if people start with trying to record voices, then they eventually find that they don't really need the tape recorder. Or sometimes they'll be recording and they'll just know what it's going to say, and they play it back and sure enough it's there, but they didn't hear it, they just sort of knew it was there. And after a while, sometimes people find that they can actually get the impressions, sometimes clear words or pictures. But they're usually not 100%. Sometimes they won't come at all, and sometimes the impressions will be there. They very rarely seem to come to perform for, like a television studio or something.
You know what freaks me out is when I always hear the sounds of children. Not that it scares me, it's just freaky. It's sad.
It certainly is. It's a very distressing thing to hear. And sometimes, I don't know if this will bring much comfort, but sometimes it's because the voice is just incredibly warbled or moving quicker. So sometimes if you play around the speed, you see it might sound more like someone a little older. But yeah, certainly when it sounds like a clear child voice, it's a little freaky.
Seances, you a believer in that?
Yeah. It's one of those things that has been manipulated. Houdini had a great time exposing the tricksters years ago. Because a seance is a perfect place to do some fraud, right? I mean, it's a dark room. You're all sort of sitting around a table. Who knows what's going on behind the scenes, behind the curtains. But seances are also a great example of a bunch of people focusing on one thing and trying to tune into one thing. And one thing I've seen time and time again is that whenever an experiment occurs with a bunch of people involved, it's not just doubled or tripled if there are two or three people. It's more like quadrupled or maybe 10 times as strong. It's like an exponential increase.
How important is the medium?
I think the medium's important. Sometimes the medium's important just as a psychodramatic figure, someone who, if they have the right demeanor and seem to exude the right authority, other people in the room will focus better. They'll tune in better. But sometimes the medium's also the one who can do something with all that gathered intensity, the one person in the room who can pick up that weak signal that comes in.
When you, and I'm sure you've been to a seance or two, do you look around to see if they're, you know, setting up things or if they've got speakers under the table?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a trained stage magician and mentalist, not because I put on shows in Vegas.
You are Criss Angel, aren't you?
No. But I learned pretty much the same stuff for a different reason. I like to be able to debunk. I definitely don't ever want to be taken, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, if I'm going to study this and look for the truth, the last thing I want is to waste my time with a trickster.
Have you caught some of them in the act?
I've seen it, and I've seen it in high-profile events where I really can't say anything for litigious reasons.
Until later, I guess, or...
Yeah, totally. Some of the people who have the most popular names in the field are definitely not legit.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'll just put this out there. If you were going to film an 8-minute segment where you're supposedly talking to someone's deceased loved ones, and it takes 45 minutes to film that 8-minute segment, mm-hmm. What does that tell you?
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever heard of any situations where the individual is so obsessed with contacting their beloved one that they will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars with a medium to do this? I mean, do they get taken that way too?
Oh, sure. And the worst is when the person is sort of high profile and they don't realize that finding out information about them is way too easy. I mean, in that case, a medium wouldn't even have to, or a fake medium, wouldn't even have to resort to something like cold reading, which cold reading is, of course, now the new...
What is that?
The new seance, the made-for-the-TV age. It's where you literally pump for information and do so in a way that the person being read only remembers the hits and not the negatives.
Interesting. How can you give me an example on that?
Well, one good way to do it is if you're in the same room as the person, you can read their body language, see how they respond to certain cues.
And the person being the person who's trying to look for their departed one.
Sure. Okay. And I mean, if they're particularly distressed, it's extremely easy because they want it to work so bad.
Yes, they do.
They're not even going to try and be skeptical. And usually what they'll do is, I mean, and this is an old mentalist technique. It used to be done in fake psychic shows on stage. What you would do is you would use a lot of positive reinforcement words. All you remember was that a lot of positive words were said. And people in the audience sometimes will remember it all as being positive. For example, if you keep saying, yes, yes, do you understand this? Does this make sense to you? Yes, yes. If you keep throwing all the yeses out there, the only thing the audience remembers hearing is yes.
Yes, yes. Yeah, this guy's good.
Yeah, he was never wrong. Even if the person's like flinching or, you know.
Yet during some of these hoaxes or frauds, it is real in some cases, isn't it?
You know, it could be. It's a funny thing about acting. It's just like before when we were talking about vampires. If someone acts something and pretends it enough, every once in a while a real glimpse will come through. What I think is interesting is I'm sort of wondering if some of these people think that they're not using cold reading. And every once in a while,
yeah. They
do actually get something real, and it just reinforces it.
They luck out, basically.
Exactly. But from what I've seen, I don't think the dead come 100% on demand.
But you do believe the dead is out there.
Yeah. And again, it might not necessarily be for the explanation that we want it to be. It might not be that they're exactly in the heaven we're visualizing, and we can reach out to them forever and ever. It might be, you know, a parallel universe theory like we talked about. It
right.
might just be a recorded sort of emanation. Or it could be, I mean, this is a stretch, but it could be our own latent psychokinetic ability imprinting their voices on a tape. But that would be the ultimate wish fulfillment, right? I mean,
I have had people, Constantinos, call this program saying that they have received telephone calls from their dearly departed, and the caller ID will be very strange. I mean, all ones, for example. It's just weird. What's going on there?
I've seen that phenomenon. It's been around a long time, and it's yet another electromagnetic emanation. Anytime, anything like this really loves electronics. Any kind of phenomenon like this definitely manifests electronically. It's pretty much the same as a tape recording. Sometimes it's solicited. Sometimes you literally ask, and you get this kind of phone call. If you think about it, the mechanism for making a phone ring is a lot simpler than recording a minute of audio.
We will, in your last hour with us, the third hour, open up the phone lines, and you may get some incredible calls from people who've had their loved ones call like that. I remember one where a person, their grandmother called after they had died. They didn't know it, of course, the individual. And then, you know, he gets a call from his mother and says, you know, your grandmother died, and he'd already talked with her. I mean, it's really weird things like that.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. The immediate sort of distress apparition phenomenon comes through in phones and dreams and other things.
What about the computer age now? Does that have anything to do with this?
Yeah, it's the same kind of technology being used. People are trying to capture everything from text to images right on their computer from the other side. A couple of years back, I had an online seance where everyone sort of tuned in at the same time. And
how did that work?
Strange things really did happen. It's funny when you do something over the internet. The internet is a perfect medium for any kind of occult phenomena to build and grow because, I mean, it is really, it's a network. It's a way a lot of people can focus. Whenever you're doing something on the computer, it's very cerebral. It's usually a good focuser of your attention. And it is sort of like holding hands at the world's biggest table.
What do you recommend to someone who buys a house and finds out that there's something very strange going on here? It's haunted. What do they do?
Well, I think the first thing they should do is try and figure out what kinds of phenomena they're experiencing. Try and really identify, is there anything malicious happening, or is it just sort of like recordings in the walls? I mean, a lot of hauntings are just really sort of silly. It'll be like a room that feels weird, and every once in a while you'll see something there, but it's not really particularly intelligent, or it doesn't really try and make contact with you. Sometimes it's almost like a tape recorder in a wall, really. Like you'll walk in a room and you'll just hear something playing, essentially, over and over, and it doesn't really do anything.
Your work that we're talking about tonight, and they're all incredible, are they available on bookstores, Amazon.com? How do they obtain all these, you know, summoning spirits, which we'll talk about next hour? All your books.
Yeah, they've all been in print since they came out, which I'm pretty proud of. Yeah.
Good for you. Well, I guess the best way then, if you go to like Amazon.com, is just to type in your last name.
Well, yeah, I just have one name.
And all the books show up then.
Yeah, if you just type in my first name, Constantinos, they'll all come up.
I like that name.
It's my real name.
First name, last name?
It's my real first name, and okay. I just dropped the last name.
They ever call you Connie when you were a kid?
No.
All right. Well, look, you do a great job here, and I want to talk with you about the summoning up spirits when we come back, because on Wednesday, Constantinos, I am going to do an experiment that I am beginning to have second thoughts about, and I want
to
get
your listeners are actually writing me about it, telling me to tell you not to do it.
Well, I'm going to be very curious to see what you're going to tell me, but even before you do, let's find out more about what this Ouija board really is and why it does what it's supposed to do. We'll be back in a moment. Summoning Spirits next on Coast to Coast AM.